Okay, so this is going to be somewhat last week and somewhat this week, but since Mordechai liked this idea, I want to shed more light on it. So last week I mentioned that I had noticed a similarity between the Rav's general theory of Tamei HaMitzvot and the Beit HaLevi's explanation of the Egel, where again the fundamental claim that the Rav makes is that instead of starting with your values and then figure out how mitzvot express it, you have to start with Gzeirat Melech, the fact that it is Dvar Hashem, and then you can unpack value from that, which there's sort of a, let's call it a family resemblance with between that and what the Beit HaLevi says about the Egel, where he says that the people at the Egel understood that there was a problem. Sorry, that there are, in order to create a space for God, right? So any space for God will carry with it all types of illusions and you know, Kabbalistic thing, God knows what. And they tried to recreate that, not realizing that those things are only possible once you anchor it in Dvar Hashem. And again, as we noted last week, that connects to this week's parsha, or this week's parshiot, where the Beit HaLevi says, yeah, and that's why the proper tikkun for the Egel is Kasher Tziva Hashem Moshe, Kasher Tziva Hashem Moshe, Kasher Tziva Hashem Moshe. The Mishkan is the place of God's command, and that's why all of this is possible. But I was thinking about it a lot. I taught it on Shabbat, as well. So I threw it out on Facebook last night just to see if anyone had thought about this at all, and I got some very helpful responses. So let's push this idea a little bit farther. So one, the most extensive response I got was from David Kerwin, who lives in Efrat as well, who was like, yeah, I sort of wrote about this in two articles and a third one that's coming out. Now he notes that he had written an article on the comparing Tamei HaMitzvot between the Rav and the Beit HaLevi, and he noted that there is a very distinct difference, and I think this sharpens what we were talking about last week. That's why I wanted to share with you between their Tamei HaMitzvot. So he wrote an article called "Could It Have Been Different? History According to the Rabbis Joseph Soloveitchik." If you didn't know, the Beit HaLevi's name was also Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik. They're the same. His anchor for this is the Brit Ben Abitarim, where Hashem tells Avram that his children will be descendants in a foreign land, but it doesn't mention Mitzrayim per se. So the Rav then writes, well, could it have been different? So he writes, in order to understand these things, it is necessary to return to the issue of the Brit Ben Abitarim. In exchange for the land, they would have been enslaved for several hundred years. Eretz Yisrael is not mentioned explicitly. Even Egypt is not mentioned, only a land not theirs. But here a question can be raised. Haran was also a land not theirs. Why was Eretz Yisrael not given to Jacob after he was enslaved for more than 20 years in Haran? You're also going to get some Pesach things. So I feel justified in doing this. So the Rav has this very interesting claim, which is the following, is that why did Yaakov go back to Eretz Yisrael when he did? Because he thought that maybe his dwelling in Haran, which was exactly one-tenth of the period that they were in Mitzrayim, right? He goes back in the 21st year, and the Jews go back after 210 years. He said, at some level, Brit Ben Abitarim could have been fulfilled with Yaakov's time in Lavan's house. He's in Haran, right? Sorry, he's in Haran, right? And he's in a land not as, he's oppressed by Lavan. He leaves with great wealth from Lavan, and he goes back. And the Rav argues that's why we say Arami Ovid Avi at the Seder, because that was the Egypt that was the Exodus that could have been. And that was the Exodus that could have been, and why wasn't that the final Exodus? Why wasn't that the final manifestation of Brit Ben Abitarim? Because Yosef was sold, so now we had to relive that so that the final, as it were, interpretation of Yetziat Mitzrayim, sorry, of Brit Amin Mitzrayim was Mitzrayim and Yetziat Mitzrayim. Okay, was that clear? Right, so now what does that show? So interestingly, what it shows is, so first of all, history could have been different, which is fascinating. But what does that have to do with Tamei HaMitzvot? So here we come back to a very fascinating claim by the Beit HaLevi, where you see the divergence between the Beit HaLevi and the Rav. So right, last time we noted the similarity, but now we'll highlight the difference. Beit HaLevi on the mitzvah of Vihigata Levincha Bayom HaOlemar says, I'll read you his translation, but if you want, you can read the whole drasha, which I went through last night. The foundational essence of this commandment, why the commandment is such, is not because of what happened in Egypt. For the Torah preceded the world, and even before the world existed, there was the Torah, and written in it was the commandment of matzah. And Avram, our father, and all the patriarchs kept the entire Torah before it was given. And therefore, on the night of the 15th of Nisan, Avram ate matzah and maror, even though this was before the Egyptian exile. And therefore, it must be that these commandments did not sprout from the redemption of Egypt, but from the opposite. Right, so the Beit HaLevi says, following the Kabbalistic view of the Staka Baraita Barama, that God created the world based on the Torah, he says, you think that the reason you eat matzah is to commemorate the Exodus? No. The story of Mitzrayim had to happen so that these mitzvot would make sense, because the mitzvot, right, because the mitzvot preceded the world. Now the Beit HaLevi goes even farther, and if you read the full drasha, he thinks that is the sin of the Russia at the Seder. When he says Ma avodah zot lachem, right, he's asking, well, what is all this historicity and what does this make sense? And he's a heretic because he thinks the mitzvot are historical.
Oh my God.
But what this shows, right, so what David Kerwin notes fascinatingly is that maybe our analysis from last week, exactly, is that even if our analysis is correct, right, that both the Rav and the Beit HaLevi insist on starting with the principles and then unpacking meaning, they diverge because the Rav thinks history could have been different, and presumably, therefore, right, if we didn't have to go to Egypt to fulfill that, then presumably the mitzvot around Yetziat Mitzrayim didn't have to happen in this way. Now, their value still comes from Dvar Hashem, but God is commanding things in light of what actually happened in the world, where the Beit HaLevi takes that view on steroids is probably the right expression, and he says, no, so much true does the value of mitzvot come from the fact that they are Tzivui Hashem, that even if they reflect history, you've got it backwards. That means history has to play out in a way as to make the possibility of commemorating that history possible. Which shows, on the one hand, a certain similarity between their views, but it also highlights a difference, which I think is fascinating to analyze. I will also note that this morning I was very touched. I did not expect, I didn't know, you know, sometimes I use my Facebook very limited, but sparingly, and I use it usually for things like this, for Makarot and like ideas. So you never quite know who's going to respond. So this morning I woke up to something that touched me, which was Lawrence Kaplan commented. You know who Lawrence Kaplan is? He's the guy who translated Halachic Man. So he, what? From Hebrew to English. Like the translate, if you've read Halachic Man in English, you've read his translation. Yes. He notes that he, right, he, so I'll read you what he said. He wrote, very interesting comparison. Note, though, that the Rav speaks more about the move from objective to subjective. Though, of course, he mentions Gzeirat HaKatuv, right? That for the Rav, right, he notes that there is a similarity, and again, I would call it a family resemblance in multiple ways. But going back to what we talked about last week, and this is based on the Kabbalah issue, that the Rav focuses much more on Gzeirat HaKatuv as if to say that the mitzvah would have to be objective and then meaning, subjective meaning unpacked. Whereas for the Beit HaLevi, who's using the Kabbalistic language. It really is about gzeirat, right? It's not about objectivity, whereas it's about gzeirat hakatuv and the fact that istakel ba'alma, right? That God istakel ba'arayt of our alma, that God looked to the Torah and created the world, right? That it does carry, right? That the fact that you take out the Kabbalah does actually change whether it's just objective or subjective or what. He said they both view gzeirat hakatuv, and also he said for, and this was very interesting, just so you know, he wrote also, since he's not a Kabbalist, for him the subjective is not affecting Ashrat HaShchinah, but inner experience, right? That's another difference, right? That the by removing the Kabbalah, and then this comes back to our parsha, I figured I could justify it in saying this week, right, is that for the Beit HaLevi, when you're talking Kabbalistically, you're talking mystically, so it's really about bringing about the Shechinah's presence, whereas for the Rav, the focus in his examples in Halachic Mind is about, right, inner experience, which is different, right? So again, I would note a family resemblance between them, but the particular version of it, as the Beit HaLevi said, because of his Kabbalistic influences, first of all, puts it on steroids and says that history couldn't have been different, right? Because the mitzvot needed to have this objective anchor that nothing could possibly change. Whereas the Rav doesn't seem to have bought that because the Rav thought history could have been different. That's point one. And the second point is that even if there's a resemblance, right, for the Nefesh HaChaim, for the Beit HaLevi and the Kabbalistic side of it, the centrality of this for Hashrat HaShchinah is much more central, whereas for the Rav, it's more about starting with the objective and letting that influence subjective experience, less talking about the effects on the cosmos and things like that, which is the difference. Now, but he did agree with what we noted last week, that sometimes the Rav does this, right, where he takes sort of views from his family and then removes the Kabbalah, and that changes in the process. And he noted, and he added here that when I translated the Rav's citation of Nefesh HaChaim, I noticed the Rav neatly excised all the techno-Kabbalistic references from those citations. And then he said, I do not remember if I ever mentioned that, though I will be referring to it in my forthcoming expanded edition of Halachic Man, scheduled to appear in September, which was the first I'd heard of it, which is very exciting. But I was very touched to for him to respond and to agree with the similarities and to sharpen what we talked about last week. But the difference in presenting this Kabbalistically and not through a Kabbalistic lens, where it actually changes it in substantive ways, in both David Kerwin's analysis and Professor Kaplan's analysis, help, I think, sharpen, while there is a similarity, right, the Kabbalah, the Kabbalistic background does actually change the way in which you would manifest the type of idea.
So
okay?
One question, one comment.
Yeah.
So I'll start with the comment, I guess. At first I was going to ask, so it's kind of weird with the Rav that like he does believe in this Platonic ideal of halakha,
yeah.
But then that would make it contingent. But I guess that, but the Platonic, but now I guess the Platonic
right,
ideal
not
is a, kind of shifted.
Correct, and it's not quite Platonic as it is objective, right? And that was Professor Kaplan's point.
Right.
Is that for the Beit HaLevi in a Kabbalistic world of istakel ba'arayt of our alma, it's very Platonic. And therefore it has to exist,
yes,
even without the historical angle, where for the Rav, it's about objective. It's about divine command giving it objectivity rather than personal interpretation giving it subjectivity.
Yeah, we typically use those interchangeably.
Correct. And that I thought Professor Kaplan sharpened
that's
that.
So interesting. Just a question. What does the Beit HaLevi say about or any of it?
Oh, and that he doesn't comment on that point.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think so. Okay, anyways.